processing centers.
There are MPD approved units outside.
What's the temperature in here?
Minus 18 degrees.
Minus 18 yes. Celsius?
Yes, Celsius, right.
That's what it's like in the depths of winter with us. My God, they're not going to stay.
All to Europe.
I thought the Japanese used to take a lot
of
the stuff.
We were selling some time back.
Yeah.
And now we have discontinued, not discontinued. In fact, one of the buyers who were there in Japan, they discontinued buying from us.
Yeah.
And we have located two markets in Japan. So we are trying.
But Europeans pay well.
Pardon?
Europeans pay well?
See, before the introduction of these mechanized boats, we were getting, you know, more or less equal share of the fishes. There was not much of disparity in the catch. But once these mechanized boats were introduced, they used to get a better catch than those who didn't have these mechanized boats.
So what have you done? Have you gone and mechanized? Or are you still not making a good living now?
Yes, now I have a mechanized boat.
Thank you.
It's a very, very poor catch. It's a bad season for fishing.
Season is very recent. Season for us, I mean, the name is
no doubt it's a season, but we will get a time when we may not get. We cannot say. The fishing itself is such. It all depends. Because we don't have any other alternate work on the job, we have to resort to this, whether we get it or not. See, 50 families are involved in this fishing expedition. And I don't know how much each one may get out of this small catch. So it's just a macro, you can call it a macro, but we have to do this. The amount involved in fishing this expedition is too high when compared to the catch. But the very boat passes 100 rupees per expedition.
For common man, bank is not doing anything. Only for those who know who have little bit money, and those who are reasonably well to do, they get money from the bank. But not the common man and the poor man.
This is Morning Edition. I'm Bob Edwards. Floods in Bangladesh killed thousands last fall and left millions homeless. And much of India has been gripped by a terrible drought through the past few years. A major cause of both is deforestation in the Himalayas. India's government has committed itself to massive replanting, but a shortage of funds and corruption have combined to hamper those efforts severely. Now, in the Indian Himalayas, some villagers are taking matters into their own hands. Julian Crandall Hollick prepared a report.
Aaj Himalay jagega.
Patthar wala bhagega.
Aaj Himalay jagega.
Patthar wala bhagega.
Aaj Himalay...
Today is the festival of Balasundriya Mata, and the villages of Tano in the foothills of the Himalayas have a lot to be thankful for. Samsia Singh is one of the village elders.
I'm from this village, and there was a quarry which was working about 7 kilometers ahead from this village. And the quarry people, they used to blast the hills, and the sand was coming down, the stones were coming down. They were destroying the trees. The vegetation was almost finishing, you know.
The villagers met and decided they had to close the quarry. Against them were powerful mining and timber interests who quarried and denuded the Himalayan slopes of much of their once lush cover of trees. The villagers turned for help to Sundarlal Bahugana, a Gandhian activist and environmentalist. Bahugana, a wiry, white-bearded man of 60, lives in an ashram on the top of a mountain, surrounded by even bigger mountains, deep within the Himalayas. The other mountains are virtually bald, just rock and scrub. Bahugana's mountain is full of trees. For the last 20 years, he's carefully reseeded with oaks, maples, spruce, cedars, apple trees, and mountain rhododendrons. Every morning, under a tall poplar tree that he holds sacred, Bahugana and his family sing hymns and pray for the health of the trees.
You know, when you use more and more things, you destroy nature. Your relationship with nature changes. And that is the main cause of ecological crisis today. Because modern man has become the butcher of nature. For modern man, everything in nature is a commodity. This tree is a commodity. This is a resource. But according to our culture, this is something living. And it has right to exist. But according to our materialistic civilization, this tree means how much timber it has, how much firewood it has.
Back in the early 70s, timber companies threatened the trees in Bahugana's village. He helped the villagers adapt Gandhi's techniques of non-violence to saving their forest. The timber merchants came. The villagers tied themselves round the trees. The timber merchants left, defeated. Bahugana and the villagers called their movement Chipko, literally to hug a tree. From the beginning, Bahugana realized that Chipko could only work if it was a grassroots organization. So when the villagers of Tano came to see him, Bahugana told them to form their own local Chipko movement. The villagers wrote to the government for help, but the government didn't even bother to acknowledge receipt of their letter.
We were very angry. So one day we all, villagers, we all went to the quarry and we put our tents over there on the road.
Ramesh Kukreti is the organizer for Tano's Chipko group. Ramesh and the other villagers put aside their caste differences, took their bedrolls and cooking pots, and started a sit-in right in front of the quarry.
There'll be not a single truck which will pass from this road. If you want to pass a single truck, any truck from here, that truck will go from our bodies.
The quarry owners sent hired thugs to beat up the villagers.
In fact, they also beat me, and I have also injury on my head. And still, sometimes there is problem on my head. But finally, one day, our dream come true, and we were successful.
He just picked up sticks and left.
Yeah.
He's never come back again.
He never come back again.
The villagers of Tano had stopped the immediate danger to their environment. Now they had to reverse the damage. The hillsides looked as if they'd been hit by a hurricane. There was scarcely a tree left standing. The villagers sat down with Bahugana and drew up a list of all the different types of trees they would need. Trees for timber, trees for firewood, trees for animal fodder, trees for fruit and honey. The Forestry Commission sold them the saplings and they started planting. Samsia Singh is now convinced of the benefits.
We plant trees because by the trees we get clear air, clean air. By trees there is no land erosion, soil erosion. We get natural water. These trees, these are very old trees. And we think that it is only because of these trees we are getting this water which is coming down below. So by trees we have a lot of advantages. And of course we get fuel from the trees. When any branch of the tree is dried up, then we cut that branch, but only when it is dried up.
Most villagers apparently agree with the aims of CHIPCO. But as this farmer in Tano told us when the CHIPCO organizer's back was turned, conservation and making ends meet are not always compatible.
Yes, I feel that we should be allowed to cut the trees because we are in a village and we have to cook our food. We have to have the fodder for animals. From where will we bring our fuel?
But doesn't cutting down trees destroy the hillside and dry up the water supply that you have here?
Though we know that we are spoiling our forests, we are spoiling the beauty of this village, but we have no alternate. We try our best to cut only dead trees, dead branches, but sometimes we cut green branches also. Sometimes. You tell us, what is the solution if we don't cut the trees? Now you tell us.
Of course, there are no easy solutions. Most people agree the root cause is simply too many people and too many animals on too little land. Sundarlal Bahugana says poor management of the forests is also to blame. The government, not the villagers, own the forest. Bahugana believes the government should turn over management of the forest to the villagers.
So this is what we want, that the whole land use should be changed with a view to make people self-sufficient in their basic needs from their surroundings. And once you make people responsible, then they will devise their own ways and means.
The CHIPCO movement in Tano and other villages up and down the Himalayas has become a rallying cry for all those who care for India's environment, and a way of involving villagers in finding solutions to the crisis of India's disappearing forests. The efforts of the villagers here in Tano and throughout much of the Himalayas may be the proverbial drop in the bucket. But if the destruction of the forest is to be slowed or even reversed, the solution will probably have to come through the education and efforts of ordinary men and women in the Tanos of this world. For National Public Radio, this is Julian Crandall Hollick reporting. Six farm workers are threshing wheat on Jagjit Singh Hara's farm, here in the heart of the Punjab. Jagjit Singh Hara is a tall, rangy Sikh, dressed in blue jeans and plaid shirt, smeared with engine grease. He bends down, picks a handful of wheat, puts one between his teeth, and cracks it.
When you put it under two, generally the farmer, they take out the grain and put it on it. If it makes the noise, ready.
Punjab is a picture of prosperity and health. And Jagjit Singh Hara is one of its best-known success stories. He started with nothing, but now owns 80 acres, a two-story ranch house, outdoor swimming pool, and brand new car. He works hard and admits to earning more than $60,000 a year. But there are more than 3 million farmers in Punjab, and for the vast majority, the Green Revolution has been a cruel illusion.
As far as the its gains are concerned, it has done a very good job. But as far as the benefits have not gone to the real workers. Benefits have been, cornered, I can say, by big business or big officers. The small peasants, they have not got enough to sustain themselves, rather, what to talk of making money.
Daljit Singh is a dairy farmer in the border area near Pakistan. He owns 5 cows on 1 acre of land, just enough to make a living. Daljit says many small farmers have gone into debt, buying tractors when their farms cannot justify them. He says they don't make enough to pay back the costs of sinking tube wells or bringing electricity to their farms to run the water pumps. Daljit blames the Green Revolution for failing to provide enough jobs to soak up the labor coming off the land. And Daljit estimates that Punjab has lost 400,000 farmers. He says this is a cause of the unrest in the state.
But are you saying that much of the trouble here in Punjab is because basically there are too many unemployed young people?
Definitely, this is one of the big points. Look, there's a lot of unemployment in India. This Green Revolution has created a lot of unemployment in Punjab.
And many of those farmers have been forced out because the farming is no longer profitable.
10 years ago, when the cost of the per quintal of wheat was fixed at 110 rupees or so, you could buy a tractor for 35,000 rupees. You could buy diesel for 1 rupee or something per litre. You could buy fertilizer at a much cheaper rate than what today.
Kuldip Singh Dhalipal farms 15 acres of wheat and rice just outside the city of Amritsar. The Green Revolution for most farmers was short and sweet. It lasted barely 4 or 5 years in the early 70s. Then the price of oil went through the roof. The cost of fertilizers and pesticides doubled and tripled until they caught up with yields.
Today, while the cost of wheat is maximum 173 fixed by the government average price, you have to buy a tractor for 120,000 rupees. You have to buy diesel at 350 a litre. The cost of equipment, the cost of labour, the cost of fertilisers, the cost of pesticides, all have gone tremendously high.
Jagjit Singh Hara agrees that the huge increase in yields were a one-time phenomenon, unlikely to be repeated.
Are the yields still going up?
The big jump was there when we got the new seeds. Now there's an increase of 5%, 6%, very nominal increase is there. Mm-hmm. But even if to maintain that level, whatever the new seed they gave us, it's quite a big challenge to the farmers, mm-hmm. because there's a lot of drain on the soil.
Strain on it.
It's a lot of strain and drain on the soil.
Jagjit says many farmers have ruined their soils. The land often needs 5 years lying fallow before it can be productive again. Jagjit now tries to minimize his use of chemicals, so he's using organic methods to keep his soil in good health.
Well, is your soil in good health? I mean, it's basically like an invalid who's taken about 400 different types of pills, it would seem.
But to make the soil sick is very easy. But to bring it back to the on the line, it's very, very difficult. And similarly, some of the other...
Jagjit's neighbor is Mohinder Singh Garival.
You see the gap? Yeah. 24 inches lines, then 48 inches gap. My own research.
What are you planting there?
This is cooker beets there. Already 3 crops are out in a year,
what
single
beets?
Year. Cooker beets.
Okay,
muskmelon, you can say.
Okay. Well, I wouldn't have guessed that.
Jagjit says a farmer needs 25 acres minimum to make a living from the land. Mahinda, like the majority of Punjab's 3 million farmers, has considerably less than that. On his 12 acres, Mahinda used to grow rice and wheat. But rice especially needs vast amounts of precious irrigation water. In the past couple of years, the water table has dropped alarmingly by over 10 feet. Mohinder, like many other small farmers, has switched to market gardening, which uses less water and less fertilizer.
Here, I take 15 to 16 crops in a single year on this 12-acre farm. All these crops, now there are about 8 crops standing here. See, this is carrot for seed production. This is cauliflower for seed production.
Mm-hmm.
This is your sunflower, which is so see the distance of the plant to plant.
For now, Mahinda makes a decent living. But when he dies, his farm will be split in two between his sons. Fragmentation of farms doesn't decrease yields, but it makes farming unprofitable. And Mahinda's younger son doesn't want to stay on the land.
There is no profit in the farming. So I can just earn 3,000 rupees per month when I am in a government service, other facilities, what I can earn here in the farming.
Well, it seems that judging by your father, you can earn at least that.
My father has 12 acres on and a share. I got six acres in my share.
Mm-hmm. The two of you.
What will I do in 6 acres? There's not much profit.
Mohinder tried making honey for the big hotels in New Delhi, but he ran smack into a problem that plagues many fruit and vegetable farmers: the almost total absence of any marketing or wholesale network to get the product from the farm to the retailer. One young farmer, Lakhbir Singh, who lives near Gurdaspur, grew lemons because he'd been told there was a big shortage of lemons in urban markets.
When Jugnu Ramaswamy had come, at that time I had a huge amount of lemons, but nobody was willing to buy here. And somebody told me to take it to the town. So I put them in a big bag and took to the town. And even there I found no buyer. So ultimately I had to exchange it with somebody who was selling fry fish. So I got half a kilo of fry fish in return for that. So marketing is one of the major...
Lakhbir's angry. He thinks the Green Revolution's a cruel hoax on small farmers like him. He thinks the solution is a food processing plant. Pepsi-Cola wants to invest in one, right here in Punjab. But the politicians and bureaucrats in Delhi are frightened. Maybe Pepsi will be the thin edge of the multinational wedge.
You see, now the things have changed. See, the land holdings have become smaller, the cost of production has gone up tremendously. So that early stage in which the Green Revolution brought prosperity, that is over.
Kuldip Singh Dhaliwal accepts that the Green Revolution has removed the specter of famine from the face of India. Some farmers have become extremely rich by Indian standards. But for the vast majority of Punjab's 3 million farmers, the Green Revolution is now threatening to devour its children. For National Public Radio, this is Julian Crandall-Hollick reporting.